Hello there, everybody. Welcome to another edition of Cambridge Inside Out. I'm Robert Winters, and today is, what is today's date? March 19th, 2024. So I thought what I would do today, I mean, I certainly want to talk about some of the what happens here locally, but maybe in the spirit of the program's name, Cambridge Inside Out, I'm actually thought I might step a little bit out this time. Some of you may know, in addition to being involved in civic affairs, I'm also involved in a few other things, one of which is, I guess back here, I maintain the cover site for the National Lampoon, but I'm also the webmaster and publisher of the newsletter for a historic preservation group called the Middlesex Canal Association. And another role that I have is that twice a year, once in the fall, once in the spring, I'm the leader of a, we do walks along sections of the old Middlesex Canal. So I thought maybe I would just take this opportunity since we did one yesterday. Yesterday was our spring walk. For those who don't know much about it, that I might just, you know, introduce people to a little bit to this. So Middlesex Canal, which ran from Sullivan Square, Charlestown. And by the way, that's named for James Sullivan, who was the first president of the Middlesex Canal Corporation. And it was, they began constructing it in about 1793. It was the first real transportation canal in America of any significance. I mean, there were some inland waterways and things along some of the southern states, but as a, you know, a serious endeavor, it was considered at the time to be kind of the big dig of the 18th century. And with the largest public works project in America, actually. And it ran for 27 and a quarter miles from Sullivan Square at Charlestown, all the way up to what was then called Middlesex Village, because the city of Lowell was not yet created. So now Middlesex Village is a part of, in the western part of the city of Lowell. And it passed through a number of towns, including Somerville, Medford, Winchester, Wilmington, Chelmsford, big piece in Woburn, as well as Billerica, on its way up to Lowell. And there are, I think, a pretty good significant amount of the Middlesex Canal is still there, totally visible, contains water. It's not particularly navigable, but there's also relics throughout. So I was just, you know, again, just to share a little bit of, you know, the walk, what I did yesterday. I was going to maybe just sort of show you a couple of little quick things having to do with the Middlesex Canal. Then we can get back talking about Cambridge stuff and all of that jazz. So one of the places where we began our walk is depicted here in this sketch. This is actually where the lower Mystic Lake, or excuse me, it's on the upper Mystic Lake, where the Abajona River flows into the, becomes the Mystic River around the Mystic Lakes. There used to be this rather spectacular aqueduct that stretched across the Abajona River up there. It's not there anymore, but you know, and this was an early depiction. There were two different versions of this aqueduct. You know, by the way, this may actually also be along where it crosses the Mystic River on Boston, which is today Boston Avenue. I'm not actually quite sure where this one is. But that's actually where we began our walk. And then we took our walk down to the site where there used to be this absolutely fabulous, spectacular bridge called the Brooks Bridge on the Brooks Estate in West Medford, which was really a very popular place for outings back not only in the 19th century, throughout the 19th century, but even into the 20th century, but now it's largely consumed by house lots. We identified exactly the site along the walk here yesterday. I'll actually show it to you on a map in a minute. I was going to just sort of point out one sort of oddity that some of you may know about the city of Medford, which is that the infestation of gypsy moths in America was actually began as an accidental release of some essentially silkworms in the city of Medford. And it's kind of interesting if you actually look at this picture from the late 1800s of the Brooks Bridge on the Brooks Estate, which was an accommodation bridge where the Middlesex Canal, this photo is taken after the Middlesex Canal was no longer operational, but you can kind of see the root of it passing under the bridge. But you'll see that so many of the trees are, you can detect this, are banded. And those were just like today. It's a way of preventing gypsy moths from the larva from crawling up the trees. So you can kind of date the photo as being largely in sync with the gypsy moth infestation. In fact, actually, for those who are in the know, even this postcard view of the old Middlesex Canal and the Brooks Estate, you can actually see the banding on the many of the trees in the vicinity in order to address the gypsy moth problem. Anyway, if anybody ever wants to go for a little venture out there, I'm more than happy to take people along there. We, with the Middlesex Canal Association, we actually commissioned a whole archaeological study. And I was just going to just sort of show if you wanted to actually see some of the relics of the Middlesex Canal. On the upper Mystic Lake, there's a little place called Sandy Beach, or Shannon Beach as it is now called. And it's where the Mystic Valley Parkway runs along there, and the beach is sort of right in here in the center. And it's very close to where the low line on the railroad, which is that is the rail line that eventually put the Middlesex Canal out of business. It's right here. And you can actually see some of the features that are still visible today. This green section here is not filled with water or anything anymore, but you can completely see the prism of the canal. The canal bed with the towpath on one side and a berm on the other side. And even you can see a little inlet here, which is like a little turning basin for the boats back in the late 1700s. And then that aqueduct, which used to be a lot longer, but the land forms have changed somewhat over 100 and over 200 years, really. But our walk actually went along here. We traveled along the Mystic Valley Parkway, where we followed the route of the canal. And eventually, close to where Martha Coakley lives, which is just up the hillside from Mystic Valley Parkway, over to a place where a street where you leave the Mystic Valley Parkway and hop onto a street called Sagamore Avenue, which eventually becomes Boston Avenue, which eventually crosses the Alewife Brook Parkway on its way in through Medford and Somerville. But right here, at a place called Sagamore Park, was where that Brooks Bridge was located. And we had the pleasure of speaking to one of the abutting residences, who basically said that some of the stones from the bridge are in not only her foundation of her house, but along I've spoken with other homeowners along here where, in fact, some of those good construction stones, so the bridge, were actually integrated into some of the homes that were built as part of the Brooks Estate. One other sort of interesting thing is that if you actually go up here over to, right along Grove Street, where the park, which is really left from the Brooks family, there's actually a rather significant feature there called Pomp's Wall, or the Slave Wall, which was actually built by slaves, actually a single slave in 1765 for Thomas Brooks. So it's been preserved, and it's viewed as a historic site in the city of Medford, right? By the way, the Middlesex Canal, just as a cross section, was about 20 feet wide at its base, 30 feet wide at the level of the water, and contained within a berm and a towpath, where this was a traction canal where oxen and horses would actually pull the canal boats along the canal. And for those who may not know of it, and I did mention it a short while ago, but It actually ran from Charlestown and Sullivan Square up through pieces of Somerville. Actually, Somerville didn't even exist at the time. It was considered part of Charlestown. And beyond the Neck, and the Neck is where Sullivan Square is, into Medford, Winchester, Woburn, Wilmington, up through Billerica, Chelmsford, up to the Merrimack River. And it was actually continued. They were bypass canals all the way up to Concord, New Hampshire. And at the southern terminus at Sullivan Square, there was actually the means to pull the boats across the Charles River. And the real final terminus was actually Haymarket Square. And in fact, the street that actually continues the Middlesex Canal going right into Haymarket Square is still there today, is called Canal Street. And it is so named because of the Middlesex Canal. And by the way, you can just see from a little cross section or a little slice of a map in Charlestown. There's also a canal street. There's a lot of canal streets along the route of the Middlesex Canal, but the Middlesex Canal came right down here into the Mill Pond, which is now like where the Hood Dairy is. And anyway, it's kind of great. At least in my view, it's a great thing to actually know where you live. So I mean, I've lived in Cambridge for 40 odd years, and I make it my business, and I think everybody should get to know some of the history, not only in Cambridge, but in the surrounding cities and towns in the vicinity. Boston, not only Boston and the famous stuff along the Freedom Trail, but there's some really very significant historical remnants and well-preserved historical remnants as well, of a very, very interesting part of American history. Middlesex Canal is just one of them. By the way, the engineers of the Erie Canal in New York came here to Massachusetts to learn how to build a canal from the engineers of the Middlesex Canal. So it really was a kind of a pivotal piece of history, transportation history. And industrial history. In fact, the whole corridor along the Middlesex Canal became sort of dotted with towns which became sort of industrial centers because of the existence of the canal. And again, there's some pieces of the canal are still there, and we have lots and lots of photos on our website, by the way, which is middlesexcanal.org. And if anybody wants to join me on the next regularly scheduled walk in October, probably September or October, we'll be doing another one then. But as I mentioned, I'm more than happy to walk anybody along pieces of the Middlesex Canal. Just drop me a line, I'll do that. I mean, just sort of speaking personally, I mean, I come from originally from New York and Astoria, and I'm kind of aware of the fact that we had movie studios in Astoria that predates Hollywood. And then when my family moved to Whitestone, that's actually where a lot of the movie actors of the day lived, was in Whitestone, New York. I mean, Mary Pickford was there. Actually, Gracie Allen and George Burns lived there for a time. Charlie Chaplin, Burl Ives, and more. One town over, by the way, which is where Christopher Walken is from in Bayside, is also the home of W.C. Fields, who is one of my personal comic heroes. So then, anyway, that's some of my roots. And as I say, people should really get to know where they live. It's not just a place to put your head on the pillow or make some money or invest in your real estate empire. Really get to know the history of where you are. I'm going to throw just one more little piece of my personal history. So I went to Flushing High School. Flushing, some of you may know, it's actually named, it's a bastardization of a Dutch name for a town of Vlissingen. And it actually has a rather important distinction in American history through something called the Flushing Remonstrance, which is in 1657, which was really viewed as the watershed moment for a declaration. It was really a protest letter from the Dutch inhabitants of the day, which really set, it was really a watershed moment in the history of religious freedom in the United States. So So I'm actually pretty proud of the places I've lived, including where I am now in Cambridge, which is in one of the most historic cities you'll ever find anywhere. You know, and I don't know, maybe that's a has affected me in some respects in terms of my obsessions with history. All right. Something else I'm going to mention, and I think I'll also do a little bit of a share screen. I'll have to do a little navigating to get to it here, but there was something that I just happened to pick up on, somewhere the other day. They said that some people in Somerville, actually, perhaps I believe associated with the Mystic River Watershed Association, had started an initiative which I thought was just perfect. One of the things that I've been doing for the last, I don't know, 35 years or more, is that I make it my business to clear the storm drains in my neighborhood. You know, whenever there's going to be a big storm and there's leaves or debris cluttering, it's going to cause flooding around here. I take my trusty dirt rake out there and I clear all the storm drains. You know, I've been encouraging people to do this for as long as I can remember, but not too many people take it up, you know. So what was really kind of delightful was that these folks from Mystic River Watershed Association actually took it upon themselves to create essentially a registry where people could claim storm drains. And I believe it started in Somerville, but then they brought it right over because the Mystic River watershed includes parts of Cambridge as well. And you know, so what did I, you know, I first thing I did was I, you know, signed up here and it's kind of a fun little tool. And I claimed five storm drains, which are the ones that I regularly clear. And my neighbor Helen claimed a few up on Fayette Street. So I'm just going to encourage everybody, if you could go to this, it's just at cambridge.mysticdrains.org. It's if you get the city up daily updates, there's a link to it there as well. And claim a storm drain. You know, just you don't have to go far, just whatever's on your street, you know, keep your dirt rake handy because there are many storm drains in the city, and there simply will never be enough personnel in the Public Works Department to get to every one of them. So this is a perfect opportunity for volunteerism in the best sense for people to actually participate and you know do something to kind of make things make your city work better. You know, I've been sort of toying lately with writing a little essay which I may or may not write soon, possibly just called Little Things, you know, just about little things that we all can do just to make things better for your neighbors, for yourself, for your city, you know, for your part of the region, for your planet, you know. And it doesn't, you don't have to do anything earth-shattering. Sometimes being a good citizen can be as simple as picking up a rake and, you know, and making sure that the drains are working properly or reporting things and C-Click Fix when it's got beyond your ability to correct things, you know, and, you know, just be a good citizen, you know, and I think you'll be happy you did. So I thought I'd just mention that a little bit. Now, one other thing that I think everybody knows I keep track of during the election season in municipal elections is I keep track of campaign finance activity. You know, it's just one of those things that I have a particular interest in. So what I was going to mention, and I have a little trouble finding it here, I suppose, but not too hard. You know, I'll get it for you in a second. Here we go. So, you know, I requested some information from the Election Commission. You know, I mean, I've pretty much wrapped up the municipal election cycle for the city council races, but there were still a few outstanding campaign finance reports from school committee candidates. So, what I did was, you know, I requested some of the information. They finally got all the information complete. And it was interesting, you know, to see because sometimes when other publications will put out information, they'll just put out information right around the time of the election. But the truth is, there's a lot of bills that are still being paid, yes, and a lot of mailings that go out. In fact, the biggest expenses of a political campaign happen like in the week before the election or even after the election. And when you're writing the checks, so they don't show up in those early reports. So if you had looked in October, November at who had spent the most money on their campaigns for either city council or school committee, you might get a completely misleading impression about it all. So anyway, I now have the complete reports for the school committee at least. And again, I'm not going to go on too much longer about this other than to say that there's a lot less money spent on school committee elections than on city council. And city council elections, at least one candidate spent more than $100,000 on a campaign. School committee campaigns tend to be a very small fraction of that. But in this year's sweepstakes, the hey big spender was David Weinstein, who spent nearly $24,000to obtain his 2016 number one votes, which also makes him the leader in the most amount of money spent per number one vote. He basically spent almost $12 per vote per number one vote. And the elections are largely determined by the number one votes. Next in line was Andrew King at $7.50. Then following in sequence, Richard Harding, Rachel Weinstein, who also tends to spend ridiculous amounts of money, though she also gets a lot of votes, so the dollars per vote ends up being somewhat more contained. Working her way down here, the last to hold out in the campaign finance reports was Carolyn Hunter, but I finally got that, and so she's spending about $2 a vote. And in terms of in bold, you can see who the candidates who actually won. So I guess you'd say the most successful a candidate who, in terms of efficiency, who actually was elected was Jose Luis Rojas Villarreal, who spent $1.20 for number one vote ultimately. So anyway, I didn't want to belabor that point, but I, just for the sake of completeness, I thought maybe this would be an appropriate time to mention that. Another thing I was going to mention, and maybe I could really go on a little bit at length for this, but so not so long ago there was some discussion of some concerns expressed up at City Council and elsewhere about some plans for Linear Park in North Cambridge, basically along the old railroad route. That's been just basically a park for, since the 1980s, I guess, is probably when it was first laid out. And it was the Red Line runs along that, but underground there. And there was some concerns expressed, which, and I didn't really fully understand them also, about, what many people feel is a perfectly good park layout as it is today, but there are some perhaps some drainage issues. And then the city had some big plans for re-landscaping things, reconfiguring things, and more. So I was curious about it. So there was a public meeting that was organized privately, not by the city, by a group called, it's like Friends of Linear Park and CambridgeForTrees.org. I went up there and tried to learn a little bit about, what this is all about here. So what I thought what I would do here is, and again, let me just do a little sharing screen here before we take our traditional little momentary break. So I went to this meeting and it was actually pretty informative. I mean, Charlie Teague was kind of the leader of the discussion, but it was a very well-attended meeting. And I guess, I mean, and I could go on about it, but one of the things I did find interesting is that all of the other interconnecting bikeways that are around here, because the bike infrastructure that is part of the park seems to play heavily into the plans from the city. There's a plan that goes along the old Fitchburg cutoff that's about 10 and a half feet wide. The Minuteman Bikeway, which is very successful, is about 12 feet wide. The section of the linear park that goes connects to Davis Square. Somerville is about 10 and a half feet wide. Yet the city of Cambridge, for reasons that I really don't understand, has just decided that this is going to be a 14 foot wide path, which is actually going to threaten some of the neighboring trees, which is one of the reasons why people were getting very, very worked up about it. And the only reason I was kind of mentioning it here, and maybe just, again, I'm not going to speak too much at length about it, is that it just sort of seems like in other facets of the city these days that the concerns about creating faster, bigger, wider bicycle infrastructure appear to overrule other concerns or other desires of people. Now, I hope I'm not getting that wrong, but you know, I've heard it said that, you know, in terms of the people who are being consulted from the public, whoever the public happens to be in any given week, tended to be dominated by some of the cycling advocates, the same people who are advocating for you know, roadway cycle lanes and such. So I'm not going to pass great judgment on this exactly right now here, but I'm kind of right now in a position where I'm starting to wonder who's driving things here. You know, is it every time they're going to do a any kind of project anywhere in the city, it somehow has to be part of a greater plan to facilitate bicycle traffic? And again, I want to be really clear. It's not a high volume bicycle route through the park. And it works perfectly well as it is right now. So I cannot for the life of me understand why they're choosing to widen this thing, broaden this thing, and you know, basically make this more like, instead of being a park with a bicycle path running through it, the plan seemed to be more like a bicycle path with some amenities scattered about along the way. So anyway, I'm not going to go on too much more about that, but I thought, well, what I usually do traditionally now is I'll take an artificial break here right now, and I'll come back in a few minutes with a few more things to say. All right, so in a very artificial way, let's thank you and tune in 3 seconds or so for another exciting edition of Cambridge Inside Out.